Welcome to episode 54 of the Infectious Historians Podcast. I'm Merle Eisenberg.
And I'm Lee Mordecai.
It's March 24th, and in today's episode, we're going to continue on our mini-arc to discuss another person who is famous for his work on a particular disease. It's also going to be our first episode with a returning guest who was a big hit on his first episode, so we thought we'd have him back to help launch our second year. The guest, of course, is Mike Vann, who is a professor at California State University at Sacramento.
As listeners may recall, Mike has worked extensively on disease, imperialism, and colonialism, particularly about plague and cholera. And last time we had him on in September 2020, it was to talk about his great graphic history, The Great Hanoi Rat Hunt, which explores many of his areas of interest in this medium, which, by the way, got my students intrigued. So hi, Mike, and thanks for coming back on the podcast as our first returning guest.
Hey, guys. It is an honor to be back and an extra honor to be the first returning guest. Do I get a commemorative jacket or a gift bag of swag or something?
I can promise you that when we do get some swag, you'll be the first one to get it.
Okay. Baseball caps. Baseball caps would be good.
I'll remember that. So as you mentioned, Merle, so this is really our second episode on a single figure. And today we're going to talk about Alexander Yersin, one of the scientists who discovered the bacterium that causes plague and for whom the bacterium will eventually be named, Yersinia pestis. Now, how the bacterium is discovered, how it is named after him, and Yersin's life is actually much more complicated. So we want to spend some time today to unpack these questions. Now, we had a great conversation about Joshua Lederberg earlier this week, actually, where we looked into his life in more detail as a sort of lens to understand the place of science around the mid to late 20th century. So Yersin should be a useful figure to understand scientists and science at the turn of the 20th century.
Yeah, I think that's a nice way to put it, Lee, that each of these figures were really products of their time. In that way, tell us a lot about both how they acted in their time and just as importantly, how we remembered them. As we heard last week, Lederberg was kind of a scientific renaissance man, we might say, right? He worked in a huge number of fields. He had an impact in policy spheres, but then has kind of been forgotten to an extent. And Yersin is known for his work on plague, and it's, I think, at least the most well-known probably figure to work on plague, but also has some problematic entanglements that are not surprising for someone who lived during his lifetime, since he was very tightly involved in the colonial imperial project by France in Vietnam. But before we get to Yersin, Lee, I know you had some elections last night, so do you have any thoughts on this? I know you have interesting responses from time to time.
Well, I'm not sure if today is one of those time to times. But yes, elections. So we've had our fourth general elections in 2 years. The reason why this election has repeated itself has not been resolved. So in all likelihood, we'll probably be headed towards a fifth election, probably somewhere around the summer. That's at least what most people believe, partially because no candidate will really be able to form a government in the political configuration that is the result of this election. Now, on a personal level, I did volunteer yesterday to observe a voting station to make sure that everything was running smoothly there. And this was my first time doing it, and I kind of realized how challenging it is to run in elections from the logistics side behind the scenes, and probably even more so during COVID.
What exactly did you do? Were you there on behalf of one of the parties, or were you there as an independent person just making sure things were going okay?
I was there as part of an NGO that is responsible for having a free and fair elections. So I essentially stood there and observed what people were doing. And I mean, I have to say they tried their best, but it is difficult. It is difficult to actually follow all the rules to the small details.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. As someone who's worked on campaigns and worked on get out the vote efforts, I've definitely noticed that it's very complex in terms of what all the rules are, but specifically following them is very hard to do even with the best intentions.
Yeah, no, definitely so. And again, I think it's been educational, let's say, more informative. But how are you, Merle? How are things going in Annapolis? You are not going to have any elections anytime soon, fortunately, I guess, for you.
Yeah, hopefully not, thank God. there are New York City mayoral elections coming up in June, or at least the primary. So that's going to be a big deal then. But I guess the main change is it's suddenly gotten pretty nice consistently here. So, you know, 60, 65 during the middle of the day, which means that everyone's outside again. And I think because of the COVID situation feeling better, I think the numbers are actually going back up in Annapolis again, largely because I drove through downtown Annapolis the last couple of days. Everyone has masks, but they're back to chin masks. And that's clearly a response to vaccinations increasing and people kind of thinking this is over, when in fact, we probably have another 4 to 6 weeks where people probably should still continue to hunker down until the vaccination numbers continue to rise. But I just don't think that's going to be the case, since restaurants, I think, have basically opened back up and bars have opened back up.
By the way, I haven't asked you, but did you have any side effects after your own vaccination?
No, it was the first shot. So I just had a sore arm for a day. So I didn't do any weightlifting on the upper half of my body.
Oh, weightlifting. That's interesting.
Well, Lee, if you had the magical machine that's called the Peloton and all the associated apps, you could do said weightlifting. And where are you, Mike? Are you in Sacramento, or are you still somewhere else during this spring?
Yeah, I'm still somewhere else. So I teach in Sacramento, California, the state capital, but live in Santa Cruz, California, down by the beach, about 3 hours away. And well, you know, there's this sense of things are returning to normal, right? I mean, the sun's shining. I got my first shot. My daughter's going back to school in about a week and a half. So tuba practice will no longer be at home. It will be at school. And America seems to be going back to normal, because we're done with this pandemic and we've returned to our traditional pandemics of mass shootings and horrific racism. So there we are. Not to bring too much of my gallows humor into that. But it's still weird, because there's still regular anti-mask protests in our town. These folks come from Silicon Valley into Santa Cruz, our beach town, and they've sort of adopted this bizarre, like, new age evangelical movement, and they have these signs that say "free hug, love over disease," and they encourage people without masks to hug them. And this happens about 3 blocks from my house, and it drives us crazy, absolutely crazy. But again, the sun's shining, and I don't know. I'll probably be teaching online through fall, so I may not be back in the classroom until January of 2022, which is not the career trajectory I expected, but things are going fairly well. My university has been very supportive. My union, California Faculty Association, has done a great job taking care of us. So, union strong.
One thing that's actually interesting, and I wonder what will happen to other universities in the fall. If I recall, California State universities were pretty much the first people to go online last fall, and everyone kind of poo-pooed you guys at the time and said, "What are you doing? This is ridiculous." And everyone else essentially folded and followed suit. And it's something I've been talking with colleagues at various places, whether it's with Lee or some of my other friends, saying that I don't think the fall itself is actually going to be 100% yet. I think the spring is more likely than the fall. And so it's interesting to see that, again, California State is leading the way and kind of recognizing that, I think.
Yeah. And the CSU system is so big, right? It's 23 different campuses, by some metric, the world's largest public university system. I believe the chancellor who runs the whole system wanted to have a 50% target for the fall, but the campus presidents have much more autonomy. And our campus president, who I think has actually done a really great job, has said that no faculty member will be forced to go into the classroom. And I think that the majority of faculty are going to continue to teach online. So I don't think we'll hit that 50% target.
Yeah, it's good to hear that you guys have the freedom to choose if you want to stay or in teach or not. I mean, I know some of our guests have not been offered that choice. So one question I was interested in, Mike, is about these people who show up. So are these just techie people from Silicon Valley who are trying to bring the gospel to Santa Cruz?
Well, not everybody in Silicon Valley actually works in tech. they're very vocal on social media. They've got a strong presence. The leader of their church, his name is David Rodriguez, and I looked him up, and he claims to have worked for Oxford Scholars Publishers. So you've heard of Cambridge Scholars, right? The shady pay for play, like no peer review publishing. This is Oxford Scholars. So he evidently worked for the knockoff of the shady publishing house. And they are out there with cameras. Like everything is being recorded. They've got cell phones. They've got expensive looking commercial quality cameras. And they're recording their entire protest. And so they've been doing things like going to the famous lighthouse in Santa Cruz and with free hug signs and like aggressively trying to hug people and saying, we love you, we love you. They've gone into the farmers markets and shut down the farmers markets where they almost got arrested for trespassing. They've gone into Trader Joe's and other supermarkets and refused to wear masks and got the markets shut down, which is just obnoxious, but they come from another county. They come from Santa Clara, which had much higher COVID positive rates than Santa Cruz County. So we're just really at wit's end. And I've had several conversations with police officers about this, and they're not enforcing public health measures because they can't handle a lawsuit. This is a litigious bunch. And if they sue the city with the financial straits the city's in with the lack of tourist revenue, it would be a disaster. So nobody is protecting us from people who just want to hug us, just want to give us some love.
Yeah, free hugs, free hugs. So I guess we can start our interview in this, like, I'm not sure if it's an optimistic mood of free hugs, but let's start from here. So I guess the first question we can begin with is to just sketch the biography of the character we're going to talk about for most of this episode, Alexander Yersin. So maybe you can tell us, Mike, who was he and why is he famous today?
Yeah. I'm fairly critical of Yersin for a number of things, but it is undeniable that his life story is absolutely fascinating. And there's a reason that he's sort of lionized as this hero and has the nom de guerre of the conqueror of the plague. He's born in Switzerland. His father was a naturalist, died before his birth, and he was college educated in Germany, which didn't go well. He was very lonely, very alienated. This was in the 1880s, and then he gravitated to Paris, and I believe he was actually recruited by some of the Pasteurians. He got his doctorate from the École Normale Supérieure in 1888 with a dissertation on tuberculosis. He also worked with some of the Pasteurians on diphtheria when he was in graduate school. He got French citizenship in 1888 so that he could practice medicine in France. You have to be a citizen to be a doctor. And he joined the Institut Pasteur in 1889 as a very promising researcher. Then they sent him off for a research project on the coast. And it's the first time he had seen the ocean. And in his letters, he talks about being captivated by the ocean and the romance of the sea. And he goes back to Paris and then very abruptly announces to the Institut Pasteur, thank you guys, this was great, but I'm going to join the equivalent of the Merchant Marine. I got a job as a ship's doctor on one of the main shipping lines. And within a year, he got a job working the line between Saigon and Manila, and then the Saigon Haiphong in northern Vietnam shipping lines.
So you mentioned several times the Institut Pasteur and the Pasteurians. Can you maybe say a bit more about who these people are and when do they get this type of collective identity as the Pasteurians? Is this something that was present at the time, or is this something that we are kind of reading back into history and seeing all those people as connected to Pasteur?
My understanding is that it's present at the time, and they're very conscious of creating this identity as Pasteurian, being a member of the Institute. And they're very, in some ways, it's rather cliquish. Then there's a real cult around Pasteur, Louis Pasteur. So the Institute really starts to gain strength in the 1880s. And I think that in the context of the secular French Third Republic, with its battles against the Catholic Church and its claiming to hold the legacy of the best aspects of 1789 and the French Revolution and science and progress and the Enlightenment. It's important to understand them as really like almost sort of secular scientific equivalents of, say, maybe the Jesuits as warriors for the Catholic Church in an earlier phase in European history. And they're an excellent professional network amongst themselves. They're well-funded, and they have the headquarters in Paris, and they'll establish Institut Pasteur around the world, I think Dakar, and then two in Vietnam and so forth.
So before we pick up with Yersin, the Institut Pasteur still exists today. Do they have Yersin's letters? You mentioned he wrote some from the sea. Is that how we know about him? Do we have diaries? What kind of materials do we work with to figure out how we got on a ship and these types of things?
Yeah, so most of Yersin's archival records are at the Institut Pasteur. He was a prolific letter writer, primarily to his mother and to his sister. Very, very attached to them. Again, he lost his father before he was born. And weekly letters to them where he just tells them everything. He also wrote quite a bit to some of the other Pasteurians and to figures like the Governor General of Indochina, Paul Dumaire, who was one of his main patrons at the turn of the century. And those are all located in the Institut Pasteur in Paris today, it's private, so it's not state access. So the Institute controls access to those archives. Not everybody can get in there. There's also archival traces elsewhere in the official state archives. The collections that I've worked with on Yersin are in Aix-en-Provence at the overseas archives in beautiful Aix-en-Provence.
Yeah, as someone who spent some time there, it's not a terrible place to go to the archives in Aix.
It's a terrible place to go to the archives because you could be hanging out on Cour Mirabeau, sipping pastis and watching the old Provençal guys play petanque and the other things one does in the wonderful Provençal cafe. So it was actually pretty rough.
Yeah, but one imagines at 5 p.m. you could roll out and get a nice rosé and enjoy the lovely weather at the very least.
Absolutely. Yeah. I'm a little facetious here. I am blessed that my main archival collection has been in Aix.
Yeah. So I guess that's a good overview of at least the first part of Yersin's life. So what happens afterwards? What's part two once he leaves Europe really?
Yeah, well, with Yersin, there's like part two, part three, and part four. Because one of the things about Yersin is these incredible turns. Like, I mean, it's a fascinating biography. It's a fascinating history. So he turns away from this incredibly promising career where he's the golden boy at the Institut Pasteur, had got French citizenship, starts working as a ship's doctor, of all things, on these two lines from going out of Saigon. And then he, at several points, one of the ships stops in Nha Trang in central Vietnam, this beautiful, beautiful little fishing village. And he finally quits being a ship's doctor and settles in Nha Trang, which is nowhere. I don't know if there are actually any Europeans there. So in terms of the colonial setting, it's nowhere and it's not economically important. And he settles down in this beautiful fishing village and decides he's going to make his home there in the early 1890s.
Why? I guess that's the question, right?
Well, this is a bit of the mystery around Yersin. This is a bit of the mystery, and maybe we can get a little bit more into the why as we start to look at some of the critical assessments of his life. But it leaves everyone scratching their heads at the Institut Pasteur, because there's Pasteurians in Saigon, which is not that far away. But Yersin doesn't want to be in Saigon. He wants to be in this little fishing village. And they try and keep him in the fold. They recognize his genius. They recognize his promises, potential. The entire time he was working as a ship's doctor, whenever there was a stopover in Manila or in Haiphong, or in Saigon, he'd explore the mangrove forests and the wetlands and do work as a naturalist. I mean, he's this very, very active mind, constantly asking questions and recording things. So he never slows down. So they didn't want to lose him. So they maintain contact with them. And then in 1892, he joins the Colonial Health Services. So he is an official of the French colonial state. And he starts to go off on these incredible expeditions. Again, I'm really frustrated with a lot of the hagiography around Yerxa and the sort of great man in history thing. But he did these really incredible things like on his own. So he led these expeditions up into the mountains from Nanchang. He discovered the site that would be the city of Dalat, the first hill station in French colonial Indochina in 1893. He hiked from the coast of Vietnam. The mountains go up, like almost immediately go up, 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 and then over the mountains into the Mekong Basin, and then made his way to a branch of the Mekong and then down the Mekong to Phnom Penh and eventually came out at Saigon. He was not a part of the Mission Pavé, the main European geographic mission charting much of Vietnam and Cambodia and Laos, but he contributed a very solid amount of geographic information and knowledge there. He idealized the Montagnards, the hill people, the tribal people of the mountains of southern Vietnam, and got along with most of them fairly well by his accounts. However, at one point he was attacked by brigands and stabbed with a spear through his chest and left for dead overnight in the forest. And in the morning, when his men found him, he directed the removal of the spear from his chest and his own surgery. And then they hunted down the guy that stabbed him. And Yeltsin was there as he was executed and photographed the execution of the guy that tried to kill him. I mean, it's this over the top kind of Indiana Jones narrative that's like really difficult to believe at some point, but here's this guy doing it. And it leaves the Pasteurians like just totally confused as to what, again, this really promising scientific researcher is up to.
Yeah. I have to say that reminded me of Rambo. Of like just like patching up yourself, really. Yeah, but that's whatever. We can talk about my taste in movies at some other point. But no, I think it's a great
Rambo didn't have a PhD, so I'm gonna stick with Indiana Jones.
I'm also gonna say, Lee, that your taste in movies, as we've learned in this podcast, not good. But you know, that's for a different discussion.
So how representative is Yersin of this type of scientist of his times, right? Was he the only person doing this kind of thing, or were there other educated Europeans kind of like going native somewhere in Southeast Asia, kind of exploring by themselves? What's the broader situation? What's the broader context in which he's living in?
Yeah, there's a number of similar figures. I mean, as unique as Yersin is, there are a number of similar figures. You have, you know, scientists in Africa and explorers in Africa and in Southeast Asia. I mentioned Pavé and the Mission Pavé. You also have de Brazza, who's also a naturalized Frenchman, not originally French, doing these explorations in the Greater Congo Basin. And you also have a number of doctors and researchers who are going to the colonial world, using the colonial setting for research in the emerging field of what they called colonial medicine, what becomes tropical medicine, the diseases of the tropics. There are similar figures, but he stands out as particularly different and perhaps odd, both for his really wide-ranging intellectual interests and intellectual production, from geography to medical research to ethnography. I mean, he's just, you know, across the board. But also, he really doesn't play by the rules of the institutions and turns his back on several promising career opportunities for isolation. And in some ways, it kind of resonates with, you know, Joseph Conrad's Colonel Kurtz, sort of a literary figure, you know, just going up the river and creating his own kingdom. And in that regard, I think he is very emblematic of patterns of European colonialism, this idea of the white man using the colonial power differentials to create a life for themselves and a kingdom in the tropics. So he establishes himself in Nanchang, which is, again, kind of the middle of nowhere. It's a beautiful place. It's a huge tourist town now. And this seems to be professional suicide. Yet he's doing this incredible scientific research. And then everything changes in 1894.
Yeah. So to continue our Indiana Jones comparison, I guess there's only one Indiana Jones, but there's the other archaeologists who often are Nazis actually in the movies, but they're also around. But we'll leave that aside for now. And maybe then we can talk about what happens in 1894, how he gets to China, and what he's credited with discovering once he's there.
Yeah. So this is chapter three, right? So Yersin he's actually up in the woods when in the forest, in the mountains, jungles of southern Vietnam, when news of the plague hitting Canton and then hitting Hong Kong. And when it hits Hong Kong, that's when it makes big news, because that's a British possession, because of the telegraph, because of mass media. Suddenly the world knows about this. And medical experts are dispatched there from a number of different countries. The British have their experts. They're working with a Japanese expert. And the French don't want to be left out. So Yersin is ordered to Hong Kong. He's actually up in the jungle, and they have to get him out of the jungle and send him to Saigon. And then he eventually gets to Hong Kong. And he discovers he's not welcome there. He's not welcome at all. And it's not Belloc, the Nazi-affiliated archaeologist, right? But it's James Lowson and Kitasato Shibasaburo, who's the Japanese medical expert. And what happens here is that it's the analogy actually wouldn't be 1930s Indiana Jones. The analogy would be Cold War, because what we're looking at is the context of the Cold War between France and Germany, the Third Republic and the Second Reich. After the Franco-Prussian War, there's, you know, there's a couple of generations of hostility until World War I breaks out. And as in the Cold War between the United States and the Soviet Union, this gets played out in all sorts of different ways with scientific competition, right? So tensions between the French around the Institut Pasteur and the Germans around Koch and his scientists get played out in a proxy war in Hong Kong. And the Japanese expert who the British brought in, Dr. Kitasato, is trained in Germany. And he was one of Koch's students. And there's a possibility, and I haven't seen this confirmed, but it's a possibility that Yersin and Kitasato may have actually encountered each other prior to this. Because at one point, Yersin was sent by Pasteur, and probably by Louis Pasteur, to Germany to study under Koch as a spy to gain information on what the Germans were up to. So when Yersin gets to Britain, he's here to help, here to do research, and he's met with just a wall. They deny him access to labs and medical facilities. And the first day he's there, his traveling companion, who was a young Vietnamese assistant, a young boy, stole all his money and disappeared in the streets of Hong Kong, just ran off with his money. So he's broke. And he's denied access to the labs. And he makes friends with an Italian priest who is a real Francophile. And the priest helps him out, has some connections, and he builds his own lab on the grounds near the hospital, because he's not allowed the official labs. And this will actually benefit him, that he had this, it's essentially a wood and thatch hut. And Lowson and Kitasato won't give him official access to samples. So he bribes the guards at the morgue to get in there and take samples from the bodies. I mean, it's just this cloak and dagger kind of stuff. And so he starts to do research on the plague bacillus. He also has a lot of time and he does a lot of field work and notices that there's some sort of connection between rats and the plague. He's also obsessed with soil and ants and other bugs.
But how does he justify to himself at least staying there, at least at the beginning, right? So why is he staying there at a place where he's so unwelcome?
Well, I mean, this is Yersin. I mean, he clearly understood that he was not welcome and face this wall of opposition, but he has this incredible determination. I mean, this is the kind of thing that does lead to this hagiography and the celebration of, you know, the conqueror of the plague. I mean, he does show these qualities. And this is a major scientific problem that he wants to play a role in solving. And he, you know, in his weekly letters to his mother and his sister, he delights in telling them about his scientific investigations and so forth.
does he feel or does he imply that he's somehow better than all these other people? Or is he seeing this as part of a kind of like joint scientific effort to try to solve the question of plague?
I think he's fairly competitive. I think he's fairly competitive and individualist. And the, again, the Japanese and the British are not working with him. There are letters that have been found between Losen and Kitasato where they are mocking Yeltsin in really, really, really obnoxious ways. There's a letter that from August of 1894 where Losen wrote to Kitasato, if you can, and he wrote, if you can kill a man called Yeltsin, for God's sake, do so. And it wasn't a serious death threat, but they just hated this guy. And there's in some of these letters, Losen would draw little caricatures of Yeltsin, making fun of him. He's Swiss, but sort of making fun of his presumed Frenchness. And also, we can get into this a little bit later, I think there's some homophobic prejudice that Yeltsin is faced with. And also, Yeltsin probably... And this is a tough one to talk about. We don't have direct evidence of this, but he probably had some sort of neurological diversity. Possibly, I mean, this is really thin ice here and dangerous to do without evidence, but probably on the spectrum of Asperger's, or not fully autistic, but had, that's probably how he would be diagnosed now. And so he doesn't read social cues well, and sometimes just doesn't work well with others. Then again, this is difficult stuff to do, and I want to be very nuanced in how I talk about it. And I also, while I'm critical of Yeltsin, I want to be very, very sympathetic to the prejudices he faced, which again, I think some of which stemmed from homophobia and prejudice against neurodiversity.
Do you think, and this is obviously also hard to answer, that the competitive atmosphere that was created might have driven him even more to basically stay there? I mean, he seems like someone who really wanted to choose his own path, but in this case, he really seems to have dug down and did the work.
Yeah. I think he likes the competition, but he also likes working on his own too. I mean, this is a guy that left the Institut Pasteur. This is a guy that was doing naturalist field observations in the mangrove swamps on his own. A guy who on his own with an army of Vietnamese and Hill tribe porters, but on his own is like the only white guy, you know, the colonial sense of being on one's own, I'd say, and with scare quotes and appropriate irony. He's used to working by himself and struggling. But so ironically, his ill treatment facilitated his big breakthrough. Kitasato was probably ahead of him in identifying the plague bacillus, but they had lab equipment and better lab equipment and had probably overheated the samples and killed the bacillus. Whereas Yeltsin's working at room temperature with fairly rudimentary scientific equipment, and that kept the bacillus alive. So Yeltsin's actually the first to be able to identify the plague bacillus. Kitasato claims to identify it. The consensus now is that Kitasato was incorrect, and they both file reports at about the same time in the summer of 1894. But in the space of a few weeks, it's clear that Yeltsin was the first, and this is a huge breakthrough. And it's at this point in the summer of 1894 that Yeltsin becomes an international celebrity and also will go on the path towards becoming extremely wealthy.
So before we continue Yeltsin's life story, one more question about the broader context here. So how do these people know about each other? How do they communicate with each other? So, I mean, the Europeans in Southeast Asia, are there, I don't know, some bars or clubs that they all frequent, or are they all writing back home and publishing in European journals, which get sent back to Southeast Asia?
Yeah, I don't think Yeltsin was hanging out at the bar. He was not good at reading social cues. He and all the others are publishing in the scientific journals. And keep in mind what's going on in the 1890s. Like, there's this recognition of this plague pandemic. You have these incredible breakthroughs in medicine and in pharmacology. And you have these medical journals, which are really exploding in their power and their influence. And you have states, colonial states, but also the nation state back in Europe, paying attention to medical experts in a way that they had not previously. So Gerritsen is able to publish his findings right away. Kitasato also publishes his findings. Lohsen publishes his findings. And they're immediately circulated around the world and immediately debated. You know, historically, it's part of this new moment in global scientific communication, I would say.
So maybe we can turn to what's a very long phase, but his post-discovery phase of his life. You said he gets fabulously wealthy. He moves back to Vietnam. How does that all play out?
Well, so after the discovery, he's brought to Paris and he's given the Legion of Honor from the Minister of Colonies and given a large financial award. And he returns to Nha Trang. So he could have gone to Paris and been the guy and had a very prominent position at the Institut Pasteur. But no, he goes to Nha Trang, this little beach town, a fishing village, and he founds a lab in 1895. I think he founds the lab. And in 1894, it eventually becomes a branch of the Institut Pasteur. And he uses the money to raise animals to make serum for various diseases. He also starts, because he's doing all sorts of things at the same time, he also starts to bring in different plants and starts to do agricultural experiments. And this is from where a lot of the money will come. So he gets award money, international fame, and then he's the first to bring rubber into Vietnam. And this becomes the main moneymaker in Vietnam in the teens and then especially the 20s and into the 30s. He brings the first rubber plant in 1898, and the first crop is in 1904. So what do we know about the history of rubber? This is at the same time as the worst excesses of the Belgian Congo, right? Why did Leopold send his mercenary team on this incredible mission of exploitation in the Congo? Because they're collecting wild rubber. There's no rubber plantations yet. And Leopold knows there's only a couple of years before the plantations come online. So they engage in essentially genocidal violence against the Congolese to collect as much rubber as they can. Well, this is who Leopold is fighting against. Gerritsen, creating rubber plantations. So he brings in rubber, that makes a lot of money. He brings in cinchona for quinine. This is the bark of a Latin American tree that you take the extract, and that's a prophylactic for an end treatment for malaria. He plants coffee. And then my favorite is he introduces coca and coca plants and starts making a cocaine extract. And in my book, The Great Hanoi Rat Hunt, I had to sneak this in because I thought it was so funny. He's making like his version of like the early Coca-Cola that's got cinnamon and a big dose of cocaine, and is suggesting it to people. And is, even Patrick Deville, who wrote this incredibly fawning novel about Gerritsen, where Gerritsen can do no wrong, he does admit in that book, like, yeah, he had a fondness for cocaine that was maybe a little excessive at times. But that's sort of in keeping with what's going on in literally scientific minds at this time. I mean, this is the time of Sigmund Freud coming up with all sorts of great ideas about the way the mind works when he's experimenting with cocaine as well. But all these crops eventually start to make money for him, and he gets more and more land, and he starts to build a very large land holding in the mountains near Nha Trang.
So was he doing all of this as an entrepreneur of sorts, at least the commercial parts of bringing in plants and buying land, putting up these plantations? But if so, how did he have thought of his hospital and laboratory? Was that some kind of white man's burden of trying to help the locals in some sort?
Well, I think that Gerritsen embodies all these different aspects of the era of new imperialism. Science will solve the problems of the backwards world, right? Western science will solve the problems of Africa and Asia. They're alleged problems, right? At the same time, there's no problem in making money. And development is a good thing. Cutting down the jungle and putting in plantations, of course, is what you would do. I don't think he would ever have questioned that, being, this is kind of a cliched phrase, but being a man of his time. So I think he embodies different aspects of the colonial mission. I don't think that the lab was particularly a financial enterprise, a money-making enterprise, but his experiments in agriculture are definitely entrepreneurial and definitely with an eye to making money. And he winds up making a pretty darn good fortune by the teens and definitely by the 1920s. He loves fast cars and he always gets the latest car. When he's sent to Hanoi in 1902 to found the first medical university, he brings the first car to the streets of Hanoi. And he's obsessed with airplanes and all the latest equipment. And he uses a lot of this money to buy these new fancy tech toys.
And send them half the world around, I guess, right? From Europe all the way to Southeast Asia.
Exactly, right. These things, you know, these would be high status items in France, let alone in Nanchang. I mean, he's got sports cars in a fishing village in Vietnam. You know, he ships a sports car to Hanoi. So the lab's interesting, though, because the lab also embodies an important aspect of the history of medicine and history of disease that I see happening in the period of the European colonial empires, and that the empires make many diseases worse. After 1894, he returns to Hong Kong several times to do plague research. He's sent to Madagascar and Canton and India to do plague research. He actually field tests a serum in Canton on a Chinese patient against the orders of the French officials and the Chinese authorities. He has to do it in secret. The patient does survive, but that serum, its usefulness is very questionable. When he tests it in Bombay, about half the patients die. And then he returns to Nanchang, and in 1898, there's a plague outbreak in Nanchang. And again, keep in mind, Nanchang is this little fishing village. The only European outpost there is his lab. It is not a major port center. And this is the first plague outbreak in French Indochina, even though French Indochina is adjacent to Hanoi, which is the foyer of the plague, as they would say. And it's pretty clear his lab caused it. His lab leaked somehow. Christos Linteris has a great article on this where he talks about, quote, leaky labs. And it's pretty clear his lab caused the plague outbreak, but the way he wrote it up, he blames it on Chinese merchants and Chinese shipping and tries to absolve his lab and himself of responsibility. He also enacts really heavy-handed measures to fight the plague. And this is also something that we'll see later on. In fighting the plague, anybody who is sick or presumed to be sick is sent to quarantine, a lazarette at the barrel of a gun, and confined there, and then their homes and their possessions are burned. And we don't know how many homes are burned, but there are photographs of Yeltsin overseeing the burning of big chunks of the village.
So first thing I'll say that there are some very interesting photos that I'm now thinking about, in both this photo and the earlier Indiana Jones photo. But how does he have that kind of authority, right? I mean, who gives him the authority to essentially decree or rule over those people?
Well, he's an official in the colonial health services. So he's invested with the authority by the colonial state.
So at some point, if I remember from your book, Mike, he eventually makes it to Hanoi and is engaged in various public health efforts there. How does that play out? And then we can maybe trace out the rest of his life as he gets older.
Yeah, so he had a very good relationship with Governor General Paul Doumer, who I believe he first met when he was coming down from the mountains into the Mekong Basin, and traveled with him and told Doumer about establishing a hill station at Dalat. So and he wrote to Doumer about the plague outbreak in 1898. So some of the best evidence we have are the reports from Yeltsin to Doumer. And then in 1902, Doumer, who is trying to build up Hanoi as this great symbol of the French Empire, decides he's going to establish the first and only medical university in the French colonies, and brings Yeltsin up in 1902 to build the medical school. And this is a big thing. This is, you know, the so-called civilizing mission of the French Empire. The reality is that the medical school winds up training more pharmacists than physicians. mostly Vietnamese and Chinese students there. And that even the physicians who received a degree in Hanoi couldn't practice medicine in France with that degree. They would have to get a degree from a metropolitan university. So Jumeirah shows up. He installs himself in a very fancy hotel. He shows up with the first car in Hanoi, as I mentioned, and raises a few eyebrows because he's always got a young male assistant from the fishing village, a young boy. When the plague starts to threaten Hanoi in 1902, Jumeirah orders the founding of the Tonkin Hygiene Committee. And this is important because it shows the colonial states responding to the third plague pandemic. It's an important public health innovation, creating this committee of medical experts to attend to public health as opposed to individual health and bodies. It's also important because he enacts a number of draconian measures, burning of homes, forced quarantines in the city of Hanoi. And this produces a lot of resentment. And then, I don't know, something happens with the rats and the bounties and all that, but you can read my book. And then he's there for 2 years, and he could have had a great career in Hanoi. He teaches at the university, but after 2 years, he goes back to Nha Trang. And it's this pattern of constantly like being on the verge of like an incredible career breakthrough and then retreating to the village. And then for the rest of his life, he bounces back and forth between Nha Trang and stints in Paris, where he enjoys the lovely beaches, builds a really nice house on the beach, buys more and more land, sells animals and agricultural products, gets a lot of money from that, keeps buying more fancy cars. And then every year he would go to Paris and stay in the same luxury hotel. And then famously, in 1940, as the Nazis are closing in on Paris, he catches the last flight out of Paris and goes back to Nha Trang and then dies peacefully in 1943. So you got your Nazis and your Indiana Jones moment there, where he's on the last flight out of Paris as the Germans are bearing down on the Parisian city.
It is a pretty dramatic story, I would say. But maybe we should ask again, why Nha Trang? Why did he keep returning there? And I'm assuming some of his letters may have some answers about that, especially the letters to his mother and sister, as you said, they've been pretty close.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't know. I'm from Hawaii, so I get it. You know, it's Nha Trang is an undeniably beautiful tropical beach, right? But that only goes so far. And I think that it's part of Yeltsin's personality to want to get away from the rest of white society. He doesn't want to be involved with others. He really takes advantage of the colonial power differential to be in charge in this fishing village, to be able to afford a very nice house and a number of servants, and to be the big man. And there's speculation on his sexuality. One of the things that we do know is that Yeltsin probably had one date and one kind of relationship with a woman in his entire life. But we don't know anything else about his personal life. And there's a lot of speculation that he was a closeted gay man. And I don't want to fall into being misunderstood here as in any sort of bringing this up in any sort of homophobic sense. But I think that recognizing that if he was closeted, his decision to turn away from these career opportunities that would have had him in Paris or had him in Hanoi for some privacy, maybe that makes sense. But, you know, as a responsible historian, I can't say that definitively. We don't have the documentation. He does not talk about his own sexuality in his letters with his mother and his sister. You know, surprise, surprise. But he is this confirmed bachelor, and that raises a few eyebrows. I think that James Lawson's hostility towards him may partially be tied to a homophobic reaction to him. He also deals with hostility from the Brits when he's in Bombay, and maybe that was part of it. It definitely is noted by the sources that he always traveled with a young male companion, generally the son of a fisherman or somebody from the village of Nha Trang. I don't bring this up simply for scandalous gossip purposes, right? That's I think that that kind of history of sexuality, which is a something I work on, is not helpful, is problematic, and is really abhorrent. However, considering that we have a body of literature that lionizes Yartsen, that talks about how incredible he was, that he's the conqueror of the plague, and celebrates so many aspects of his life and his personality, but is completely silent on this aspect, I think then that's worth noting. And even more importantly, I think that Yartsen, who's again hailed as the saint, possibly was doing the same thing that other French guys were doing in colonial Vietnam or colonial West Africa, and using colonial power relationships for their own personal gratification. The history of prostitution and mistresses in colonial Vietnam is very well documented. And perhaps Yartsen was engaging in problematic colonial power relationships on an interpersonal level that mirrored that. You know, the colonial setting gives the French access and control over Vietnam and the bodies of individual Vietnamese. This is something that I've worked on, the history of prostitution in Hanoi. And you see this very clearly in the heteronormative male population. And I think that possibly this is an analog here. However, because of homophobic prejudices at the time, he had to keep this closeted, if this is what is going on. This is again, I want to be as careful and nuanced as I can in this, and I really don't want to be misunderstood.
Yeah, thank you for being very clear. Could I press you then on kind of his legacy? I mean, you've mentioned several times, maybe more than several times, that there's a hagiography that lionizes him. So that's one aspect. And you can see, based on the story you just told, why this might be the case, right? I mean, this is a very extraordinary life, doing a series of extraordinary things. And then also, you know, having this certain manner where he's buying nice cars and nice planes. And just like today, we're obsessed with people who buy nice cars and nice planes. So what is maybe some of the aspects, aside from the ones you just traced out, that make his legacy perhaps a little more complex, we might say?
So this is why I needed to mention these more complicated aspects of his life, because he's presented as this very simple hero, the simple genius. And importantly, he's a hero in France and he's a hero in Vietnam. So he's one French colonial figure that survives decolonization. Vietnam hails him as a hero. They issued postage stamps in his honor a few years ago. He's remembered as Ong Nam, Uncle Five or Mr. Five, sort of this gentle sort of nickname for him. There's a university named after him in Vietnam. There's streets named after him in both Nha Trang and in Dalat. And so he's hailed by the Vietnamese post-colonial communist state as a good Frenchman who did good things here. And in 2014, he was even given citizenship by Vietnam. Posthumously, of course. But this is not something that post-colonial Vietnam, run by the Communist Party, who won the Battle of Dien Bien Phu, right, is doing to many former French colonials, giving him this kind of honor. And the Institut Pasteur in France more or less canonized him as a secular saint. And he's hailed in this very, very one-dimensional way as this super genius, which he was, incredible man of science, which he was, but without really exploring the full humanity of this individual, which I find very interesting. And again, I find some of that hagiography. There's a novel by Patrick Deville that came out about 10 years ago called Plague and Cholera, and it's in translation in English. It's an interesting read, but it is heroic white guy in the tropics narrative, which is just, it's really embarrassing and really begs a serious critical read along the lines of Edward Said and others.
Right. So as we're heading towards wrapping up this episode, one more question about Yartsen and his life in French Indochina. Were there any limitations to his power, or maybe to phrase things differently, could a Vietnamese person who felt they were wronged by Yartsen or any other administrator at his standing, could they have done anything to file charges or try to get the state, the colonial state, to make Yersin or any other administrator stop or get punished for whatever they're doing?
Yeah, that is a really important question. And it, I mean, the short answer is no. The somewhat longer answer is, well, no, I mean, but yes, they could have filed protests, but would the state acknowledge them? Probably not. So Yersin has a free hand to field test vaccines and serums with no informed consent. In Hanoi, there was a campaign during the cholera epidemic in the 1930s where they surrounded a poor shanty town on the banks of the Red River and forced everyone in the town at the barrel of a gun to receive a cholera vaccine, which didn't really work. There were protests against some of the measures of the Tonkin Hygiene Committee in terms of quarantining people, in terms of burning homes and possessions during the plague outbreak. And in Hanoi, where there actually is a structure for representatives of the Vietnamese community to stage a formal protest, we have records of the letters they were able to submit and to challenge the colonial health authorities. But not much really happened. I mean, they sort of tried to calm them down, and the colonial state didn't want to provoke a rebellion here. At the same time, with this sort of advent of colonial public health, these organizations really are all powerful. The colonial state is terrified of cholera, is terrified of plague, is terrified of whatever the next pandemic could be, and gave really unprecedented authority to the public health officials. So this is important because it really shows that, you know, while public health, medical, the medical aspect of colonialism is very humanitarian, it's, again, done at the barrel of a gun, done by force, and really can't be challenged.
So this also brings to mind a question I have when you mentioned that Yersin's remembered positively by the Vietnamese and obviously by the French, which is, you said, is unusual for a member of the colonial administration who are non-scientists, right? Some of them literally were taken off their pedestal physically as statues in many instances. So it seems that for Yersin or others, science seems to save their legacy. Do you have thoughts on why this is? I mean, aside from the general, you know, science is thought of positively.
Yeah, well, this is the beneficial aspect of colonialism. It's like the, you know, the Monty Python skit from The Life of Brian. You know, what have the Romans ever done for us? Like, well, aqueducts and wine and brought us peace. I mean, there are some positive things that come from the French colonial empire, and medical breakthroughs are there. Now, if we troublesome historians, infectious historians, start asking difficult questions and start really exploring power relationships and so forth, then the picture becomes a bit more murky. But if you're just making postage stamps and putting names on streets and again, engaging in this political hagiography, then these figures are quite useful. And I think that is Yersin's role in the history of colonial Vietnam.
And I'm guessing it's also a way to connect between modern day Vietnam and France, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And to facilitate further scientific and medical collaboration. So, he did help with the plague, and he did make important medical breakthroughs, but it was done in the context of colonialism. So again, as a troublesome historian, I think we have to include that.
So one last question, Mike, as we get to the end talking about his legacy, the bacterium that causes plague, Lee's favorite, and his favorite type, by the way, is pneumonic plague, but is now known.
That's actually a question I ask my students. Would you rather have which of the three forms of the plague would you rather have? And I think pneumonic plague, because it's over quickly.
Finally. Thank you, Mike.
I'm sorry to interrupt.
No. It comes back to, I think, the first episode we ever did, Lee made this claim. So this is why I bring it up all the time. But in any case, the bacterium is originally known as Pastorella pestis. and it gets renamed after Yersin, Yersinia Pestis. So could you just tell us briefly what the story is there, how it happens, and why?
Yeah, and actually, I think this is rather endearing. Yersin gets naming rights, so he names it after his teacher. If only my students would take these lessons to heart and name things after me. And so he names it after Pasteur. But then after Yersin dies, the international community changes the name to Yersinia in honor of Alexander Yersin, the one who made the discovery, not Pasteur. I think that is a sort of a kind, gentle story that I actually quite like.
Yeah, I guess on lists of things that I want done, I don't think naming a extremely deadly bacterium after myself is high up there on the list. But I guess if he was dead, he doesn't know.
Yeah, you know, the heart wants what the heart wants.
So I think with that statement, that's a good way to conclude the episode. So I want to thank you, Mike, for coming on, although you're going to stay with us actually briefly for the lighthearted segment at the end.
Great.
Yeah, thanks so much, Mike, for the interview. It's been great.
So I thought it was great to have Mike back on, and he really is such a good storyteller, you know, tracing out Yersin's life for us really well there. First from the hagiographical perspective, and then from others. And I'll just point out that I really like that good medieval terms such as hagiography have made it into modern discourse as well.
You know, Merle, that actually says a lot about you. But I mean, yeah, Mike did have some great stories, right? And some great stories that at least I haven't heard before. Yersin is this adventurer type, but also a pretty spiteful type. Like the story in which he was stabbed by this brigand somewhere on those mountains and pursued that guy and watched as he was executed and even photographed that. So that's pretty intense over there.
Yeah, I also think what's kind of crazy to think about when it comes to his life is he's in Southeast Asia kind of for random reasons that we don't really know. He just kind of goes off, ends up in Vietnam, which happens to be the perfect place when this plague outbreak breaks out, because then he's sent, he's much closer, obviously, to Hong Kong. So much of his life is kind of this serendipitous moment almost.
But he seems to have known how to make the most out of it, right? So the entire entrepreneurial phase of his life afterwards, I mean, bringing plants, animals, selling stuff, buying land. I mean, when you think about scientists today, right? I mean, if we want to connect this to the Lederberg story from the previous episode, if you think about scientists today, I'm sure some of them do this, right? Some of them do buy land and start businesses, but it's probably not this kind of buying land and starting businesses.
No, I think it's a little different, but you know, people do get patents for various things and they spin that off in terms of building themselves a nice nest egg, we might say. The other thing that was interesting turning to the second part of the episode was how much his legacy survives much better than Lederberg, right? I mean, he was liked in France, he was liked in Vietnam, despite pretty much every other French colonial administrator being removed from statues, literally in some cases. And so that was an interesting note to think with.
Yeah, I was kind of thinking about this. Could that time, so the turn of the 20th century, be more conducive to remembering this type of heroic scientist than, let's say, the mid 20th century or the late 20th century or even later?
Yeah, it's possible. I mean, one thing is it's probably too early to tell for someone like Lederberg, right? I mean, he's only been dead for about a decade. He doesn't seem to be remembered as well at the moment, but maybe in 20, 30, 40 years, things will change.
Yeah, I guess we can't really know at this point, at least. But maybe if in like our, I don't know, 21st season or something, Merle, we can revisit this question and see what happens. What happened to Lederberg's legacy?
Yeah, one thing is obviously Yersin gets a bacterium named after him, but I looked up Lederberg later on and he has a 87 kilometer diameter large impact crater on the surface of Mars named after him in 2012. So, you know, he gets something.
Yeah, the naming things in space is interesting. You know, one of the gifts my wife once brought me was to name a star after me, which is kind of weird, I guess, but she did it.
Did you have to pay for that?
Of course, Merle. That's like part of the business deal.
Sorry, I know your feelings about capitalism, so I thought maybe you hadn't participated.
Well, she bought it for me. But yeah, I mean, what do you think? They would name a star after me just because I'm like such a great scholar or something?
I would do such a thing for you, Lee.
Well, you can always pay for to get another star named after me. I mean, Lee number one, Lee number two, I guess, something like that.
Yeah, what I think it stressed there, especially at the end, was how much science really saves his legacy, for lack of a better term, right? That progress is still seen as so teleological and scientific that as long as you're putting your brick in the right place on that wall, you get a positive memory in the general human mentality.
Right. So science is somehow more justifiable than just being an colonial administrator or someone who supposedly brought progress, quote unquote, but that's probably not good enough. And maybe that says something about our own times, right? And this also ties into the discussion we had last episode about the importance of science in our own late 20, early 21st century culture, that science gives you like this free pass. And you know, Merle, this actually does tie into your favorite movie or your second favorite movie, because the first one is Outbreak, but the second one is Contagion. And there as well, being a scientist, even if you cut some corners, pass some lines, I mean, that's still justifiable, right? Because it's for the greater good. You're doing it for science. You're saving other people. That's seen as a good thing.
Yeah, that's fair. I think at some point, Lee, we're going to have to decide whose favorite movie is Outbreak and whose favorite movie is Contagion, because we just blame each other for that constantly on this podcast.
That's fair.
The last thing I'll say is I think this does call, you know, in an academic sense, for more of the work that Mike is doing, which is to tie what is traditionally seen as histories of medicine, although you and I might call it histories of disease, into a colonial context much better, right? I think this is something people do, but perhaps more from the colonialism side rather than from the history of disease side.
Yeah, I think one thing that came across very clearly in this episode is tying both those stories together, right? So you're used to hearing about people such as Yersin, for example, in a history of medicine context, of them being scientists and of their great discoveries and how they defeated plague and so on. But in many of these stories, the colonial aspect that was really part of their lives is absent. And I think what this episode really brought to the fore was the interaction between both these stories, right? Yes, Yersin is this great figure or a great figure, but at the same time, he's operating, living through a colonial context, which especially for us in the 21st century has some major issues that we need to overcome. So as Mike said, I think multiple times during the episode, we can't really ignore that part of the story and we need to bring it back when we tell stories about people such as Yersin.
I think this goes to what I've been thinking out in a written form recently, which is the lens of disease and medicine needs to be put back into its chronological context sometimes much, much better.
Right. And that, I guess, ties into an entire question or entire debate, which is more academic maybe, but it's about the interface between history and history of science, broadly speaking. But I guess that's a big question that we might want to touch upon at some other point.
Yeah, I think that's something that's ongoing and we can certainly do more of. We're going to bring back Mike because he was very excited to talk about something he's been watching and hopefully not spoil it for all of you since it's an older show.
Yeah, thanks, guys. And I know I'm bending the rules here, but I came back. This is my second visit. So my perk is I get to jump in on the what are you watching? The TV show The Nick, Steven Soderbergh production, starring Clive Owen, who's fabulous. It's set in a hospital in New York City in 1900. And it plays a little fast and loose with the history. It compresses about two decades of medical breakthroughs into probably 9 months in one hospital. But there's two seasons of it, and it engages so many things that I think listeners of this show will enjoy. You know, the pharmacological revolution, the development of public health, wrestling with pandemics, early surgeries, and getting into a lot of the moral issues around these medical breakthroughs. Plus, it's really good on race, turn of the century, urbanization, and even has a global connection. And I don't want to give too many spoilers, but in the opening episode, the pilot episode, they reference at least two of the doctors, French doctors that I've studied in my research. And throughout the course of the two seasons, they make regular reference of a number of real historic figures. And Clive Owen's just awesome. He's just such a charismatic actor. And there's all sorts of fun stuff in there. So The Nick, and it's on HBO Max.
So Merle, considering that this turn of the 20th century is essentially what we've been doing a lot of our episodes about, right? And we've discussed this in the anniversary episode. This might be something we should watch and have our own episode or discussion of what we're seeing there and how that connects to some of the themes and topics from our podcast.
Yeah, that's actually not a bad idea. We have an expert on film we could bring back as well. And Clive Owen, Lee, is in another disease movie, as you probably know, which is Children of Men.
Which is actually one of the better disease movies that I have watched, and I have taught that one as well to my class, yeah.
So yeah, thanks, Mike. That's actually not a bad idea for a future episode.
My pleasure.
Yeah, we'll give you credit for that.
So Lee, are you watching anything else, or are you movied out these days?
So I haven't watched any movies since we recorded our last episode, partially because we had the general elections. But I did watch some TV yesterday, which is an exception because I haven't watched TV in a very long time. And watching, let's say, an hour or two of Israeli TV was interesting, let's say. Let me put it this way. So there are different cultural norms in how to hold debates, and I think I've gotten used to the American way of doing this rather than the Israeli way, which I'd say is a more chaotic, so to speak.
Yeah, that's something I've always heard, is that Israelis like to argue and debate in ways that make Americans look very civilized and calm.
Well, yeah, I mean, one of the impressive things for me, I think maybe many Americans would not appreciate, but I do, is the presidential debates in the United States before elections, which, I mean, to me as an outsider, always seemed very civilized, comparatively speaking, at least. But yeah, let's put debates aside, Merle. So what have you been watching?
So I've been concerned greatly with the women's NCAA tournament. My wife went to UConn as an undergrad. So I have adopted, it's a terrible burden, but someone had to take it, the most accomplished NCAA team basically in history, which is the UConn Huskies women basketball team led by Gino Auriemma. And so it's a tough burden, but someone has to watch UConn go out and smash people every game.
So Merle, maybe you should share with our listeners how you pick the sports teams you root for.
I wish I could tell you there's a logic to this, but there really isn't. So I can just lay out for listeners, because everyone is very curious about my sports teams. UConn women, because my wife went there, so I started watching a lot of games and been to games at Gamble Pavilion.
It's a UConn women for women basketball.
Yeah. I'm a New York Mets fan because my grandmother was a New York Mets fan, so she raised me to be a Mets fan, which is really not a fun thing to be. They won a championship when I was just born, and so they've been terrible my whole life. I'm a Minnesota Vikings football fan, again, another terrible team that basically blows it all the time. And I guess the last team is I'm an Arsenal fan for soccer, only since about 2006 when they've basically been not very good. So, you know, UConn is my winning team.
And one of the things that interests me is that you seem to like different places, teams from different places for different sports. And when I used to be more into sports, I mean, I like the same, it's a city in all these different sports, right? I mean, the city was the brand for me, so to speak.
Yeah, there are reasons for this that I'm not going to go into, but yeah, it is kind of eclectic.
Okay, so after hearing about Merle's favorite sports teams and maybe pondering why he chose this very eclectic group of teams to root for, I guess we can wrap up this episode. And as usual, we'd like to thank the LePage Center for funding us and our great webmaster, Verda Canati, who has been with us for over a year. So thank you both.
Until next time, stay safe, stay socially distanced, and let us know what you think of the Knick.